You're listening to Discordia, over 50 years of student activism at Concordia University. On CJLO 1690 AM or online at cjlo.com.
My name's Piper, and I'm an independent artist, musician, and academic invested in researching alternative modes of storytelling. I live, work, and create within the unceded lands currently known as Montreal, and I'm currently enjoying engaging in forms of education and knowledge sharing situated outside of the academy after completing my master's thesis here at Concordia in spring of 2024. My background in campus community radio spans over a decade across several stations, and I'm very pleased to be here at CJLO, co-producing Discordia for you.
I'm Sydney. I'm originally from Cataraqui or Kingston and have been living in Jojage since 2010. I recently finished a PhD in interdisciplinary humanities at Concordia on the rise of magic, astrology, and related occult practices as resources for community building and political work in Montreal. I've done talk radio on antennas and CKUT, and I think of radio as a perfect methodology and companion to community-based research and activism. I'm looking forward to delving into the archives, making connections with other activists, and finding through lines in student solidarity movements in Montreal over the last half century.
This episode deals with the subject of sexual assault. We do not include graphic or specific details of incidents, but please do whatever you need to do to take care of yourself.
Did you take the training, like the It Takes All of Us? Did you have to do that?
I've taken it several times. It's mandatory. They put a course block on you if you don't take it. I remember when it first rolled out, it had a like, I'm feeling overwhelmed button that would skip a section. I think they took that out because people were probably like abusing it. And in the Concordia subreddit, you can see a lot of people making fun of the training when it first came out and talking about like ways to skip through it. Not because they were actually overwhelmed or like triggered by it, although I've discussed with many people that it is pretty triggering if you're somebody who has been affected by sexualized violence. But then the people who, you know, might actually have something to learn from it are often the ones who are actually muting it and skipping through. So it just seems totally lacking and just missing the mark completely.
Thousands of women are using two words on social media to identify themselves as survivors of sexual harassment and assault.
Those two words are Me Too. In 2006, the Me Too movement was founded by activist Tarana Burke, a sexual assault survivor who wanted to create a community of advocates for survivors of sexual violence.
We are not pioneers in this work by any stretch of the imagination. This movement is very long. And the reason why it's long is because it's not about sex. It's about power. People will not relinquish their power and privilege without a fight. And this fight is not going to end anytime soon.
In 2017, actor Alyssa Milano tweeted a call to action for people to share their experiences of sexual assault using the hashtag MeToo. The hashtag went viral and the movement gained global momentum. The movement is aimed to empower survivors through empathy, solidarity, and strength in numbers, while giving visibility to the scope of sexual violence, pushing for accountability from perpetrators, disrupting systems that allow sexual violence to continue, and to create pathways for healing and justice.
On April 11th, 2018, around 1,000 students walked out in protest against McGill and Concordia University's respective mishandling of complaints of sexual violence on campus and at the hands of professors elsewhere. Photos from the protests show students holding up signs that say things like, "Who are you protecting?" and "No more silence on sexual violence." This protest came in the wake of accusations laid against professors in the creative writing and philosophy departments earlier that year, with Concordia University launching an investigation eventually regarding the professors accused of sexual violence.
Being a Concordia student in the English department, what is your take on the culture?
I don't know, the general culture, it's a very insular little space. I don't think it's particularly different from most academic spaces.
You're hearing from a former student in Concordia's English department who also sat on the Standing Committee for Sexual Misconduct and Sexual Violence, who wished to remain unnamed.
I think when you have a relatively insular group of people, some of whom have pretty extreme power over others and no robust system for holding people accountable, people who take advantage of that tend to gravitate towards positions of power. So your real standard run-of-the-mill horrors of academia.
In his January 2018 blog post titled No Names, Only Monsters, writer and former Concordia student Mike Spry claimed that the university's creative writing department was an abusive climate where harassment was the norm, especially for students who were women. In the post, Spry references an article by Emma Healy, published in The Hairpin in 2014, in which she describes prolonged abuse she experienced at the hands of an unnamed Concordia professor while she was his student. In her words, while they were in a consenting relationship, much of what happened within it was not, going on to detail examples of coercion and the systems that normalize this kind of predation.
These men have friends, they have readers, they have peers, they have permission. Their power comes from institutional support, whether implied or explicit, and it comes from systems that rely on the victims of harassment to be the ones who take down their abusers by speaking out in public.
On May 22nd, 2018, Healy tweets,
"Stories Like Passwords is about John Paul Fiorentino. He's the professor who manipulated me into a relationship while I was a student at Concordia and he was a teacher."
Shortened for sensitivity and read by an actor, the full tweet can be found online.
After naming Fiorentino in her tweet, Healy then filed a formal complaint with Concordia.
The CBC reported that Fiorentino and another English department professor, David McGimsey, were both the subject of complaints, and their classes were reassigned to other professors. The university opened an investigation of the climate within the English department, as well as launching a third-party investigation of the allegations against the professors. Around this time, Concordia's Graduate Philosophy Students Association released a statement regarding allegations against a tenured professor in the department, condemning the administration's mishandling of the case, stating that their failure to properly respond perpetuates an unsafe environment that has no place in academia. The statement goes on to say, "This problem is not confined to the philosophy department. To properly deal with these issues, systematic and structural change in Concordia's administration is needed." That September, Concordia launches the Standing Committee on Sexual Misconduct and Sexual Violence.
The government mandated all post-secondary institutions to create like a standing committee in order to implement changes to their sexual violence policies, which was prompted by the R-Turn group, the like national action plans that were put together by them. Yeah, so I was on the standing committee. I was also on a smaller committee that was specific to the English department for a little bit, but I was honestly not very good at being on that committee because I was so burnt out and angry. So spent a lot of time just telling profs that they weren't doing enough, and that was pretty much it. But yeah, the standing committee, I think, was where things became very, very clear how little Concordia gives a shit about supporting survivors of sexual violence and how deeply invested it is in like preserving its image and avoiding legal battles, or if there are legal battles, keeping those legal battles quiet. And I was the student rep. I think there was only one undergraduate rep and one graduate student rep. And I think there was like an alternate eventually, but there weren't many student voices on the committee.
In early 2019, students learned that Concordia dropped a complaint of sexual harassment against a professor in the creative writing program without notifying the two students who originally filed the complaint. Administration similarly withheld the results of an investigation into allegations against retired psychology professor Jim Faust. As reported in The Link, the lack of dialogue between the university and the complainants falls in a long line of Concordia's mismanagement of sexual misconduct.
On October 11th, 2019, over a year after filing a formal complaint, Emma Healy, the person who wrote that piece in The Hairpin, received a letter assuring her that
"The university took your complaint seriously, and it was thoroughly investigated in accordance with the relevant university policies."
However, privacy laws prevented them from giving any more details, the letter goes on to say.
"I can, however, assure you that this matter was thoroughly analyzed and evaluated, and that any actions taken are commensurate with the findings of the investigation."
In a follow-up call, Healy learned that Fiorentino was no longer employed at Concordia. However, it was stressed that the school could not confirm whether this was an outcome of the investigation or not, again citing privacy laws.
There are so many ways that people are not able to come forward, and it's not just like people don't reach out, people do actually a lot, and because the system is like nebulous and weird, they'll talk to a prof that they trust, but sometimes they don't know that that prof is actually married to a prof who's like best friends with the prof who they're complaining about, or is married to the prof that they're complaining about actually, or they'll complain and they're complaining to a prof who is just there for the semester or like does not have any job security themselves and doesn't know how the strange policy processes of the university work. So they're like, oh, I guess go to the Sexual Assault Resource Center. And there's like two people who work there now for like 40,000 students.
There has been a sexual assault resource center at Concordia since 2013. And in 2015, Deputy Provost Lisa Osigi chaired the Sexual Assault Policy Review Working Group, which reviews the university's sexual assault policies and makes recommendations.
You go there and like I know people who have been told by people at the SARC, they were like getting into telling their story of what happened. And the person was like, oh, that doesn't sound like sexual violence, actually, before like they even finished the story of what happened. So like people will come forward, they will talk to people, and then it stops at that conversation so frequently. I think a lot of the time the onus is put on people who've experienced sexual violence, but it's just not a robust system of support. And also like when you do know the policies and you do know like the structures that you can go through, it's hard to recommend that to people because it's like, well, do you have several months to a year of your life to be thinking about this? It's just bad. So that would, I think, be why people either don't come forward or when they do, it doesn't go beyond that initial conversation. And importantly, like the university is not a legal structure. Like the level of evidence that you should have to provide to get like support and to have somebody be held accountable should not be as intense as the justice system. You know, whatever your thoughts are on the justice system, because my thoughts are boo. But like the way that the university demands like a certain level of sureness in order to like move forward with things, it's either like incredibly stupid or willfully negligent. So
Our Turn, a national student-led action plan to end campus sexual violence, says that sexual violence is a pervasive issue on Canadian post-secondary campuses. Students continue to advocate for change and are met with inaction or outright opposition from their administrations, according to Our Turn.
Our Turn is best known for their 2017 scorecard that graded Canadian campuses on their sexual violence policies. The national average for Canadian campuses surveyed was a C-, while a grade of D- spotlighted Concordia as a university with the lowest ranking sexual violence policy in Canada.
On December 8, 2017, the Quebec government passed Bill 151, an act to prevent and fight sexual violence in higher education institutions, which mandated that higher education institutions must adopt a policy to prevent and fight sexual violence put in place before January 1, 2019.
The bill does not actually decree a particular sexual violence policy that must be put in place, but the following are some examples of what it stipulates for each institution to figure out on their own. To implement mandatory training activities, procedures for reporting incidences of sexual violence, including measures to protect persons concerned and limiting impact on their studies. The actions taken by the educational institution, including response time applicable and penalties applicable for policy breaches. It stipulates that the institution must group all sexual violence-related services and resources together in a known and accessible place, and it must implement a process to ensure that students, officers, and personnel are consulted in developing or reviewing the policy, which must be reviewed every 5 years. There is also a section in the bill on accountability, where the institution must report annually on what has been implemented, the number of reports and complaints they have received, and what actions have been taken.
In August 2019, the university launches It Takes All of Us, a mandatory online training intended to combat the culture of sexual violence developed with the for-profit e-learning platform Knowledge One. Sophie Hugh Martin, the general coordinator for Speak Up, said students weren't meaningfully involved in designing the training.
Speak Up was a 2018 CSU slate that ran with a plan to help student associations and clubs implement intersectional and survivor-centered sexual violence policies based on the National Our Turn Action Plan, also advocating for improvements to mental health services at Concordia.
One student on the standing committee, formed in 2018 with the goal of addressing and implementing the university's obligations under Bill 151 and active on the standing committee for sexual misconduct, pointed out issues with the training, claiming that the university just doesn't want to put in the resources that would be required for an in-person training.
The trainings, the mandatory trainings, it makes me want to break my computer. The trainings were supposed to be in person, like in the discussions with the government when students were advocating for anti-sexual violence training and when Bill 151 was put out, the idea was that these would be in-person trainings where you could have one-on-one time, where you could like actually discuss things, where you could like see people and see if they were like having a mental breakdown when they were going through the training and like needed some space or some support or take a little break. But that would mean, of course, hiring people to do that and paying people real money with social supports around that. And universities did not really want to do that. And public funding is also being cut. So even though they were handed a huge chunk of money to make this happen, Concordia made this online training and has sold it to other universities and touts it as like this amazing thing that they've done to like support people in getting like anti-sexual violence training. So, you know, you can like mute it and skip through it, which in some ways is great because it's kind of traumatizing to watch because it's so deeply corporate. It makes my skin crawl. I do, in fact, mute it and go through it. But it's just such a fundamental misunderstanding of what it's for, or not misunderstanding. It's just they just don't give a shit, actually. And they're doing the bare minimum of what they're mandated to do by the province. And it just makes me shake with anger. It's just like bad for survivors. It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't teach anybody shit. And they get to pat themselves on the back for making things shittier than it was even supposed to be. That's my bone to pick. I'm so angry about it still.
It is traumatizing. And it's so clearly not going to reach anybody who needs to be reached by this kind of thing. Like, it's not going to change the mind or the outlook of somebody who has had sexual harassment and sexual violence normalized for them and somebody who is likely to perpetuate it intentionally or otherwise. I had the same thoughts when it rolled out. I was like, why is this online? Why isn't this in person? Like, there's no support for people who are affected by it and no accountability for people who require it.
And then also the university has like 8 counselors or something like that for like 40,000 students. So it's like, oh, do you have a problem with this? Are you upset? Wait 10 months. And then you can have 10 sessions, you know, like.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, once we get into that too, like of these already very few counselors, I think one of them is Black.
Yeah. And like the SARC, I think is all white people. Or it was like when I was looking into things, it's just like, who do people feel comfortable talking to? Who like actually has the ability to look at a structure and be like, that's just like not going to work for people of color. It's every aspect of the university is just like, how little work can we do? How underpaid and underfunded can we make this? How much can we fob off on people who are being personally affected by the violence of these structures? Sucks because people like being on these committees, like just doing so much work and running themselves ragged while also like doing their jobs at the university. Like the people who were actually decent on the standing committee would be putting in so much work, unpaid work, because they cared and because they were personally affected. And that work would be either thrown out or used as proof that the university really was trying.
Since September 2022, the university, upon request, can now inform complainants of the outcome of their complaints against employees, but student groups still want to see more done.
On October 5th, 2022, the CSU, along with the Graduate Students Association, or GSA, and the Teaching and Research Assistants at Concordia, TRAC, formally withdrew from Concordia's Standing Committee on Sexual Misconduct and Sexual Violence, or the SMSV. The action came after years of criticism from members of the SMSV and from the student body at large over the committee's lack of transparency and failure to support survivors of sexual assault.
I was involved in those decisions and like those discussions. And what it came down to is it was a lot of work to be on the committee, and it was unpaid work. And it was also like beating your head against a brick wall and like genuinely traumatizing to go in there. And frequently in sexual violence cases, the trauma is twofold. There's like what initially happens, and then the sudden realization that like the structures around you are built to stop anything meaningful from happening and stop like any healing. And so what we would hear like again and again is that the process of trying to hold people accountable within the university system was either equal to or like more traumatizing because there was no movement. It was like another inability to have your personal autonomy. So going to like these monthly meetings or bi-monthly or weekly or whatever, and like doing all the work and presenting papers and other people's policies, and constantly being met with the brick wall of the university being like, oh, we're only doing exactly what's mandated by the government. And also like our policy process is too complicated and too entangled to like actually have a sexual violence policy that works for students. That just like constant recurring thing. It just was a way of putting the rubber stamp on the decisions of the committee of like having had student consultation. So it was not meaningful in any way. And they were like, well, students said it was okay because they're on the committee.
Because the SMSV is an advisory committee and not directly a policymaking one, any student input is marginal at best, according to Hannah Jeanette Lang, former academic and advocacy coordinator at the CSU and track member, who sat on the committee. And this is echoed by Juliana Smith, the current CSU campaigns coordinator, who had this to say.
I think the most important thing for people to understand about the SMSV boycott is that it didn't come out of nowhere. It was a reaction to years of going to the SMSV committee and trying to advocate for students and for survivor-centric policy and also just an all-inclusive policy. Right now, it's really disjointed. And so the boycott was really a manifestation of the way that students had felt disrespected and unheard for years sitting on this committee. And finally, due to the admin's refusal to really concede to any student demands, all of the student seats that were on the SMSV committee decided to boycott the committee, which effectively forced the committee to stop meeting because of Bill 151. The administration needs to be meeting with students on the topic of sexual violence. And because all of the students were boycotting the committee, the hope was to use that as a pressure tactic to force them to actually start listening to some of the student demands and tangibly start implementing them. Because I think the things that students have been asking for are not crazy. They're not unreasonable. But they do force the university to admit to being guilty.
Following the union's collective withdrawal from the SMSV committee on October 5th, the university rushed to patch the hole left by the boycott in order to comply with Quebec's laws on sexual violence in universities, or Bill 151. This meant hand-selecting students without the union's oversight. In taking such actions, the CSU claims that Concordia violated its rights as a student union.
Bill 151 was supposed to mandate meaningful student involvement. Do you have thoughts on like how it could be made more meaningful or like what that would look like?
It does go beyond like a standing committee. There used to be significantly more student representation on the Board of Governors, which is the actual decision-making body of the university. And anything that we talked about in the standing committee would then have to be passed through the Board of Governors as well. So in the end, the standing committee was a place to talk about things. And we ended up doing policy revision, but student policy revisions were like mostly thrown out. It was mostly done by like the university lawyer who then, her name was Melody Sullivan. I don't know if she's still there, but she was particularly horrendous to try to talk to seriously about these sorts of things. She would be on Instagram during meetings as we were like talking about people's, you know, the horrible trauma of it all. Like people would be sharing their stories and she would be rolling her eyes and on Instagram. So that's who's writing the policy. But I guess more meaningful student involvement means what it always means, which is like actually giving students power instead of consultation. Consultation is great and fine and nice, but at the end of the day, we need to actually be able to make decisions. And the university has been chipping away at student power for ages, and they consult so very much, and nothing seems to change. So
you're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
So from what I understand, there was the task force on sexual misconduct and sexual violence that was set up by the university, and you and others took issue with the task force because you didn't have like adequate student representation or consultation. Or do you want to speak a bit more to what you saw as the limitations of that?
My name is Layla Sutherland. My pronouns are she, her. In 2017, I was the student life coordinator for the Concordia Student Union. I think it was somewhat fortunate in terms of, obviously, being part of the student union, you have a lot of support behind you and a lot of resources to really take things both to the student body, but also out into the world. And of course, the history of organizing, especially in Quebec student politics is really rich, and there are real laws that back up a lot of the rights and protections for student unions that are quite different from elsewhere in the country, where student unions occupy more of like a club kind of territory. So in some ways, it was quite interesting when the university announced that they were creating this task force, because on one hand, it very much came out as a concrete action after the allegations, but also it was actually something that was mandated by the government of Quebec, unrelated to Concordia's specific circumstances, but more as a general provision that all universities should be taking more concrete steps to address sexual violence. And so as a result, the participation of the students really hinged on the legal definition of who represents the students. And so it gave us a really concrete path to follow when obviously a lot of things were happening. There were specific individuals who needed support, but there were also students in the department that was most affected needed support as well in managing this information and processing, as well as the student body as a whole. Like, there were a lot of different needs. And as a union, while we obviously were well-placed to advocate for students, we also, none of us were professionals who could support individuals in that way. So there was definitely a bit of a tension, at least for me, in terms of how do we best support and advocate for students in this moment of like immense uncertainty about what the next steps would be before the university was offering kind of a sense of what they wanted to do as first measures. So in a way, this proposal of this task force gave us something really concrete to latch on to as the union, because they were planning to appoint students, and it was literally a Google form that students would fill out and say, yeah, I'd like to be part of this task force. And then the university was just going to go through and handpick two students who would be on the task force. And there are a lot of different issues with that, but the main one being that legally the university was just not allowed to do that. That was for the student union to appoint. And I even met with the dean of students and the legal counsel for the university prior to the press release where we announced that we were formally opposing this appointment process, to really just lay out why this would not build trust. This would be really problematic for any student who wanted to participate and feel like this wasn't just a bit of lip service. But also there were some other stipulations that they had, like students being in good academic standing, that just didn't sit right with the very real fact that when students face trauma, their grades may be something that is affected, and that to automatically exclude people based on their academic standing would very likely exclude survivors from participating in this process. And when meeting with some members of the university administration, they said to us that they didn't want students showing up with a political agenda. They didn't want people essentially having strong opinions in that context. And so that really forced our hand to be a lot more public about our frustrations. And that was key in us, in fact, being able to nominate two students to the committee. They still didn't accept our other two requests, which were to expand the committee to include four students, so there could be one person from each faculty. They didn't agree to the academic standing piece, but it was significant that we were able to choose people. And as a result, we chose students who not only met the criteria, but also were well-informed and had a survivor-centric perspective that we hoped would be an important voice on that committee. So there's definitely already conversations happening, and there were some really great collaborations between the CSU and SMU exec working with RTURN, which was an organization that was really an incredible resource at the time and helped create a report card for all of the sexual violence policies, or not all, but many of the sexual violence policies in universities in Canada, which was extremely effective tool when it came to engaging with the press and trying to leverage some of that traction into change in the university. So there were definitely pieces that were starting to kind of gain that traction, but it was just immensely frustrating to try and to hear all of this like anger and frustration and hurt from students, and to try and do that thing where you take in all of those stories and experiences and you try and make it digestible for someone who is really removed from it, and to try to find a way to effectively balance things like legal obligations with, it's just the right thing to do, with these students pay tens of thousands of dollars a year to attend your institution, and you're telling us that you essentially want their input on paper, but you don't want any messiness in what is an incredibly messy and traumatic topic. In some ways, being in the student politics bubble is such an incredible place to be, because there's so much energy and there's so much, just like such a strong sense of what must be done. I mean, it's not always the same sense, but there's such an energy to it that I think is so motivating and so encouraging, and very much stands on the shoulders of all this other incredible organizing that's happened before us. And then there's a sort of come down when you leave those spaces and realize that you're just going to interact with other institutions that have similar barriers, similar levels of disinterest in actually engaging with these topics. And you don't have this wave of energy from other people and this, you know, the things like the legal protections that allow you to kind of lobby with more strength and be able to grab the attention of the press, and all these things that just kind of fade away when you don't have those spaces anymore. I would definitely like underline our turn and some of the people involved with that as being really important resources who were building things that were both holding the universities accountable to a certain extent and just like framed in such an impressive way, like really rich policy work combined with just like effective marketing and like effective communication strategies that got other students feeling excited about policy. And at the same time, like realizing that we will never create the perfect container of justice and accountability and support within the confines of the university. And so while working to hold them accountable and kind of raise that minimum standard of what should be there, also not completely depleting ourselves in railing against that and trying to invest energy and time into building alternatives, whether that's through community support or trying to develop more anti-carceral accountability processes. And I think that's really a delicate balance that they achieved in the time that I worked with them and in the time with the student union. And it was also such a tool to connect with other groups and other activists across the country who were facing really similar problems. And I think without having connected, it would have been so much more isolating and felt a lot more hopeless to even go up against the university.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
In 2023, the TA and RA labor union reformed as CREW. Some of the goals for reorganizing under the new parent union, CSN, were to give teaching and research assistants more leeway to fight for the causes that matter most to them, which included demands like raises, more equitable workloads, and rallying for changes to Concordia's sexual violence policies. And we'll take a deep dive into this parent union change in our next episode, so stay tuned for that.
On March 8th of last year, 2024, International Women's Day, Concordia University's Support Staff Union and Library Support Staff joined the CSU, GSA, and CREW in their ongoing boycott of the university's SMSV, or Sexual Misconduct and Sexual Violence Committee, citing Concordia's years of mismanagement and inadequacy in handling sexual assault and violence cases as the driving force behind the boycott.
My name's Juliana Smith. I'm currently the CSU's campaigns coordinator, but when I was an undergraduate, I was the CSU's external and mobilization coordinator during the 2022-2023 school year. So I was around when the SMSV boycott was first initiated.
Can you speak to what some of the student demands are?
Yeah, so the demands that came out of the SMSV boycott were kind of like this three-part. First, it is about creating an alternative to SMSV that actually gives students, faculty, like TAs, RAs, more of a say. SMSV doesn't actually have like a voting process. Like you can't really pass a whole lot through it, because at the end of the day, it's like most of the administration committees where they just want students to participate, but they don't actually want to use that participation to meaningfully accomplish anything. Another one was revolving around various policies that the university has regarding the treatment of gender minorities on campus. So like things like, and I'm unsure sure of if this was fully resolved. This was really something that Crew was taking on, was like the ability to switch your name in My Concordia. Before, it was like a pretty arduous process, and there was like a constant issue with staff, particularly TAs and RAs, getting dead named. So that was one thing. And then also like the cameras that are in the gender neutral bathrooms, like calling out that that's a really weird and invasive practice that reaffirms a lot of really messed up stereotypes about queer people. I think there were also demands around the protection of services that primarily target women and, again, gender minorities. So like protecting the daycare, because that was a big thing that was happening on campus at the time, is like the university was threatening to shut down the CPE, and they ended up extending their lease quite quickly. But the lease is like, I think it's actually ending this year. So, you know, it's not an issue that's been fully resolved or addressed.
What's the role, as you see it, of the CSU in demanding a better response from administration to the culture and specific accusations of sexual violence on campus?
The issue around sexual violence is such a pressing issue within university spaces. Like, I can't remember the exact figures and stuff, but like, you know, that period of like the first 2 weeks of school when orientation is going on and there's a lot of different student life activities like that, the percentage of students that experience sexual violence during that period is staggeringly and disgustingly high. And even though the university isn't the one facilitating these events, that does fall on the different student associations. And I know a lot of the student associations have put a lot of mechanisms in place to try to protect people in those situations. But these issues of sexual violence are happening in people's cohorts, and eventually the issues translate onto campus. And so there's things that the university needs to be doing to protect students, not just from instances of sexual violence in the first place, but also in treating survivors in like a fair way that is not going to re-traumatize them as they're getting help and access to services. I think the thing that frustrates me the most about the university is Concordia loves this reputation of being this progressive institution, and they have this habit of co-opting a lot of the really radical narratives that students have put forward, like the creation of the Center for Gender Advocacy and the Sexual Assault Resource Center. Like, these are both things that students initiated, and at least for the Center for Gender Advocacy, that's still run by students through their board. But, you know, with something like the SARC, the university has co-opted it. And so all of the advocacy work that came out of not just the CSU, but especially departments like the English department and the philosophy department, and the work that students did in those departments has been kind of twisted and co-opted into this "it takes all of us" training, which is the university's way of trying to clear their liability that they have around sexual violence on campus, and not actually meaningfully address, you know, the ways that things can be changed. There's so many students that are in particularly vulnerable situations that expose them to sexual violence in a university setting. And the university could be doing so much more to address the different power dynamics and the ways in which that students are isolated when they're at university and away from home for the first time that put them in these vulnerable situations. Instead, they've created this half-baked training that they're now selling to other institutions, being like, this is the pinnacle of what it means to be survivor-centric. Like, I think it's just like that compounded frustration within the collective consciousness of the student body and how that kind of like transfers over from cohort to cohort. I think the CSU has kind of become this house for all of that frustration. And that's why the CSU has continued to put these issues forward, even if it's not, I mean, I think these things are still being discussed by current students, but if it's not at the forefront of everyone's mind, the CSU does still bear that institutional legacy and this responsibility to the students of the past who have continued to advocate on these issues. So even if it's not the top priority on everyone's agenda at this very moment, I think it's still important for the CSU, just for the sake of doing right by those students who have put their hearts and souls into this work. Advocating around issues of sexual violence is not an easy thing. It's deeply personal for so many of the student activists that have participated. So I think there's a real responsibility to those survivors and needing to uphold the fight. And that to me is why, you know, this would be the third year or school year that the SMSV boycott has been in effect, and we will continue to uphold it as long as the university is not meaningfully addressing the demands. And they really haven't.
Is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap up?
Yeah, I would say like the Cruz Feminist Workplace Committee was really the engine behind the SMSV boycott. And like there's still ITFA, which is essentially, you know, we are demanding this alternative. ITFA is the alternative we continue to meet.
And what is ITFA?
ITFA stands for the Interorganizational Table of Feminist Affairs. It's kind of a mouthful, but it was the alternative that was essentially created to SMSV. So there's reps from CSU, GSA, CRU, and some of the staff unions as well have continued to slowly join us. So I think we've got workers from the Library Workers Union and from the Support Staff Union.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
Our focus has kind of been more on just how the administration has totally failed to show up for people, how it's dodged like accountability, and how like a culture of sexual violence is enabled to continue flourishing in universities, rather than like focusing on the specifics of like actual cases and what went down.
A lot of the people who are organizing around how to get better policies on sexual violence or whatever that looks like to support survivors more, there is a preventative aspect of it for sure, in that, okay, if you train people, if there's, you know, more of a, you build like slowly over time, more of a like culture of safety, whatever that means, hopefully, you know, that can also prevent this from happening. But I think a lot of what is so like traumatizing about this isn't just that it happens, because like anyone who has ever been like a victim of sexual harassment or violence knows that there's not just like a place where these things are contained. It could be anywhere. And what I think is particular about the university or like the institutional case is that it's not about the institution's like duty to prevent it from happening. It's about how it responds to and supports people who bring allegations to them, and what are the things that are in place to make sure those are heard, to make sure that that person's studies aren't like are protected or not limited as much as they could be. How do they demand accountability from the people that they're literally paying, things like that. So I think that there's what I think one of our interviewees talks about this, where there's kind of like the two levels of traumatization. There's the thing that actually happens, and then there's the process by which you are consistently having to like back it up, provide sufficient evidence, or continue chipping away, I guess, at the like closed door. And that's the thing that most of the like organizing actually, you know, ends up focusing on, is why the closed door. Is there a way to like make it a little bit easier to get through it? Can you complain about something that happened at the institution to the institution? Or is that always going to be fraught with like power that is interested in like keeping the table as it is and the people at the table as they are?
Yeah, definitely. And in researching for this episode, I read kind of case after case of students whose academics suffered and their futures suffered, not just because of the initial thing that they went through, but because then it was at the hands of a professor teaching a mandatory class or of a classmate who faced, you know, no penalties. So the perpetuators of these violence get to keep teaching or keep attending class and get their degrees and move on with their life. And then the people who are affected maybe end up dropping classes or trying to transfer schools, and it's really difficult to transfer schools if you dropped, say, a mandatory class or failed out of a class because you stopped going because you felt unsafe, or not felt unsafe, because you were unsafe. And so the lasting repercussions of, even in the instance of an isolated, like one-time incident, which a lot of these things aren't, a lot of them are drawn out and pervasive, the repercussions can follow people for the rest of their lives. I think I read about one person who, just collecting all of the evidence to try and make their case of what they'd gone through, was so much work, it just took precedence over their coursework, you know?
Totally. And this, the kind of mental load of having to come up with something that is satisfactory in order to get accommodations, like this person, Aaliyah, who shares their story about having to, you know, end their studies and actually even leave Montreal after an experience of sexual assault, talks about how she was given accommodations to, you know, have an independent grader instead of the professor in question, but that the other two courses that had suffered because of this during that semester that she had, you know, had to drop out of. She wasn't allowed to have those kinds of accommodations because they weren't considered, it wasn't considered a sufficient enough excuse that she had decided of her own accord to leave the city, things like that. So there's kind of a limit to how these policies maybe focus on like a particular relationship, but not all of the kinds of small failures that are happening outside of that and the domino effect.
Yeah, I think related to that is this issue of like privacy, where to bring your accusations forward, people end up having to really publicize like what they went through and put their own name out there. And then there are all these privacy laws and then the university's own policies that go like, okay, well, but we have to protect the name of the person accused because innocent until proven guilty or whatever else like legal garbage is standing in the way. And, you know, you end up with the privacy of the perpetrators of this violence better protected than those of their victims. But yeah, so you're going through all this work and, you know, maybe other areas of your life are being sacrificed to try and get some kind of justice. And then you're doing it in this like really public way.
Yeah, I think the issue of privacy is interesting because there's like this dance that happens where there's this blurred line between confidentiality versus actual containment. And maybe if there's a victim who, you know, it's been a few years and they're wondering what the hell's happened with the case, and maybe they can't find out any information because that's confidential. And it's also, you know, this is to protect you. This privacy is to protect you as a victim as well. And then that kind of gets used or weaponized, while in effect, it's what's actually happening is that privacy is working in the benefit of the university also to contain this like scandal to a particular place. And Sarah Ahmed talks about this, where in her own research with people who have issued formal complaints in academic institutions around sexual violence, but also racism, her interviewees talked about ending up just kind of in a file. The file is put away in a cabinet. The cabinet's in a room. The door to the room is locked. And that's that. It might be that you're at an event surrounded by peers and maybe you signed a confidentiality agreement, or the institution that's hosting the event is the institution in which the thing happened. There's a restriction on what you can say about what went on. So the file isn't just the papers locked up somewhere in the institution. The file becomes you. You have to keep it closed, and that weighs you down. It holds you back. It can be incredibly painful to know what happened, to know what you went through, but still you can't say it and you can't get out. So I think this idea of like you also being contained somehow by the university is interesting, in that like they require you to maintain privacy. And what often happens is that in order to like sabotage that system or break out against it or kind of dissent from it, like you're saying, you have to kind of explode yourself as the private file. You have to go public. You have to kind of work against that force of obscuring. And that can be really painful by like in that vulnerability of putting yourself out there.
Something we learned through our research that I was really surprised by was that prior to 2018, Concordia actually did not have a specific policy or guidelines around professor and student romantic or sexual relationships. And now the policy is essentially, I think, just avoid it, but declare it if it's happening. There's this graphic by Loriana Lastoria that, Sydney, you found in a CBC article that goes back to the 80s about Concordia's history of sexual violence on campus. But so the point is, we see that there are records of things going back that far, and yet they only implemented a policy in 2018 and after, you know, a lot of external pressure and this bill being passed. To me, it really just points to a lack of initiative, a lack of ownership by like the university administration to, like, they're not being proactive about these issues. They're really only dealing with them because they have to. And even then, they're falling short.
You know, I always think about, there's this systems theorist who says the purpose of a system is what it does. We can't claim that the purpose of a system is to do what it consistently fails to do. And I think there's something here that brings our focus back to a kind of like politicization of even working groups such as like sexual assault working groups. Even if the intentions are totally great and they hire totally great people to do them and they come up with very sound recommendations, I'm not saying that can't happen at all. In fact, it's really necessary. I think that we can't keep looking at constant failures of those recommendations to turn into anything as just a mistake that needs another working group to figure it out. We have to look at those failures as like actually part of the veiled intent. That is the system working exactly as it is. I was actually working in the Social Equity and Diversity Education Office at McGill in 2017 and 2018. And this was the time, at least in my memory, where like the language of DEI was like really exploding in this like new way. And it feels like there's something really connected here with a consistent complaint or experience that a lot of people have where they're brought into the university to like address something that people agree, you know, is a problem. And it just churns people out. And you just get a new person's hired the next year. One person comes, gets burnt out, makes recommendations, is like located as the problem or the killjoy and gets booted out and someone else comes on. You know, my office was actually dissolved into like a different place in the university and the staff were distributed elsewhere. And that kind of like refashioning goes on and on and on and on at McGill and Concordia, and all the sort of institutional knowledge or the knowledge that people brought with them or generated gets lost. And I think part of that is actually somewhat intentional.
Yeah. And I think in pretty much every issue that we've looked at and are going to continue to look at, where it comes down to like, okay, there's this problem. And then the other problem is how the university administration is failing to handle it. And it's such a common tactic on the part of the administration to wait people out because they know students are going to graduate and move on, or people working in these really particularly exhausting areas are going to get burnt out and have to move on or take leaves or just they'll dissolve their unit or whatever.
Totally. I think just to go back to Sarah Ahmed, she talks about how formal complaints can sound just kind of like what you're saying here. So referencing the famous Audre Lorde phrase that the master's tools can never dismantle the master's house. But one consequence of that, the formal complaint being a form of taking up the master's tools, is that in doing so, you actually come to hear and learn and confront those institutional mechanics maybe more visibly than you ever have before. So you're witnessing firsthand how institutions reproduce themselves. And so this is something I think we've come up against many different times in our research and our different episodes, where in addressing the issue in the university, there's the recognition of like what is being blocked. And I think that is like really powerful in terms of exposing the mechanics at work and what they're privileging, who they're protecting, and who they're letting fall through the cracks. I was thinking today about like, okay, like how do we maintain the focus on student activism? It is a bit of a particular case. Like it's not all like demos and flyering and, you know, it's about how do you create structures that will like support the people who like can't necessarily be visible. And like so much of what we think of as organizing is like literally manifeste, like being present in a space. And like, I think what is difficult here is that there's actually real things that are preventing you from being present in the space when it comes to like sexual violence. And that affects like how we can understand what activism looks like around it.
Yeah, it's true. Like there seems to be a lot more of the activist work being done by student groups. You have these groups like the CSU, GSA, Crew, etc., boycotting this standing committee that is basically lip service to show that we need more and we need actual work done and not just committees that are going to have the same cyclical conversation that goes nowhere and does nothing and then checks the box of like, look, we're doing it, you know. And then there's places like the Center for Gender Advocacy and places that actually offer peer support and like real support for people. There is the SARC, the Sexual Assault Resource Center, although I've seen plenty of critiques of the SARC as well. So I don't know that's another imperfect system. But yeah, the activism just looks a little different here. And it's this really long-term battle, kind of behind the scenes more so, I guess, than what we're used to seeing with like, yeah, manifestations and postering and flyering and chanting in the streets.
You're listening to Discordia on CJLO 1690 AM.
We've talked a lot about what's not working and what's wrong. Is there anything that you think is working?
I do think that having a more organized student body and like a more politically active student body necessarily keeps people safer. Having serious social connections on campus where you already know that your actions have meaning and you have autonomy and like you and your peers can do something about problems is, I think, the most useful part of this kind of organizing that's actually helpful for people moving forward and healing, especially around trauma that's so specifically to do with being robbed of your autonomy. And so I think like Palestinian justice groups on campus and also like the unions that have been organized, crews organizing, it's always helpful. And I do think the sort of inter-union solidarity networks that have been growing are necessarily going to make for a place that is safer, not just for students, but also for workers. Because usually the sexual violence issue at Concordia is framed as like a students versus faculty sort of thing. And it's not. It's a everybody versus the administration sort of thing. Because one, faculty doesn't want to be working with sexual predators around them. That's not great. The people who are TAs don't want to be working with people who are sexual predators. It's about workplace safety, and students are intellectual laborers as well. So when profs have labor protections and rights and also robust complaints processes, it supports a community that can actually address issues instead of just like trying to silence them because you don't really know what to do with them. So I guess the union organizing and the student mobilization are the only things that I see as being particularly good.
Thank you to Juliana Smith, Layla Sutherland, and our unnamed guest for their interviews, our volunteers Nikita, Sophie, and Remy for their work on this episode, and to the CRFC Radio Meters program for funding Discordia.
Contact us at discordia@cjlo.com with questions or to get involved. You can find this episode in the archives at cjlo.com, on SoundCloud, and on Spotify.
Tune in on Monday, March 10th at 6 p.m. for our next episode on the 2023 Crew Unionization Campaign on CJLO 1690 AM and CJLO.com.